Sometimes life feels out of our control. We get stuck in trauma, old patterns, and change feels out of reach. Sometimes it feels like fate. We want to help you break out of old, unhelpful patterns and become healthier. We're Fate Resilience, taking control of the outcome.
With licensed therapists, Jennifer Oxford,
Taylor Madsen,
Haley Mayer.
So just a disclaimer to the viewers, we realize that these episodes are pretty heavy. So
yeah, last time was heavy enough for me that I just straight up zoned out.
Only in the last part. No, but I think so. I just, if anything, I want to refer back to our self-care episode of just how are you enriching yourself, not just staying above water? How are you going to help yourself with that? Because some of these topics are not even the fact that you have experienced these things, but maybe these topics are just a heavy topic to just to go into. And the reason we have it, it's not just to make people feel uncomfortable. It's honestly to give a research-based approach to trying to explain these things, so there's a resource out there. It's not even the fact of we really love this, it's more the idea of we get questions about this all the time. I mentioned this last time, we all use this podcast as a resource at times for our clients, and we repeat ourselves over and over again, and it's just nice to have a space and a database to have this info there, and for those who are also trying to research the topic, having a safe place to know where to get the answers.
I think it's a good reminder too that this is not necessarily one of those binge podcasts where you should listen to it for like 6 hours at a time, you guys. There's a reason the episodes aren't super long. So if you forgot that, what's the phrase, Haley? You should go
touch grass. I was gonna go. There's a lot of places
I've so many phrases, but
touch grass is a great one.
Go outside, take a break, listen to some music. Because some of this can be activating, and that can move you into other feelings
and
experiences.
And not just because you've experienced this yourself, just listening to this stuff is heavy even when you haven't experienced it.
Yeah, it's a true story.
Mm-hmm. So today we're going to talk about physical abuse. We've talked about neglect and emotional abuse and overall what trauma is. Today we're going to talk about physical abuse. So we're talking about hitting, kicking, throwing things at someone, biting,
shoving.
Yeah.
So I have the American Psychological Association definition here.
We're ready. Go for it.
It was interesting because I looked up several definitions, and I will tell you that almost every state has a slightly different definition. So I was like, okay.
For legal purposes, yeah.
Yeah, for legal purposes. But here's the APA. It says physical abuse is deliberately aggressive or violent behavior by one person towards another that results in bodily injury. Physical abuse may involve such actions as punching, kicking, biting, choking, burning, shaking, and beating, which may at times be severe enough to result in permanent damage or death. So, did we talk about heavy yet? That's heavy. It just does say that it's most frequently observed in relationships of trust, which is so sad to think about, right? So between parents and children or between intimate partners is where it's mostly observed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that that word deliberate is going to be a huge indicator with that, right? It's not just that it was a passive situation. It's not just that it was an accident, right? You can accidentally become physical with someone, right? There can be times where not meaning to shove someone or not meaning to fall into someone or something like that. Like that happens, right? But we're talking about a deliberate scenario, and not just deliberate of other people, saw as deliberate, like your own action.
I don't get hung up on how deliberate physical abuse is or isn't, because sometimes someone is inebriated or they're high, and that's when they engage in physical abuse. And then people will say, well, I didn't mean it. I was just drunk. And it's still physical abuse.
Well, but even in that, though, it's not even, that's someone in hindsight looking at it. And it's saying like, but in that moment, you deliberately raised your hand, right? And deliberate doesn't necessarily have to mean like I am thinking through, I want to harm that person. Deliberate in this sense is I physically moved my hand up to harm someone, right? And so we're not even saying like deliberate in the mental consciousness of what it means. It's the idea of the reason I moved my foot was to make contact, right? And so in that moment, they are definitely trying to pick straws of like, was this deliberate or not? Because I would never do that with my right mind. However, while you're under the influence, I don't have to think about it. I just know if your hand was moved to smack someone, that becomes deliberate, whether or not that would be your usual thing, right?
So it's interesting. So there's the word deliberate, but also when we look at the word of just abuse, the meaning of the word abuse has multiple meanings, but one is just the misuse of something. So the mistreatment of something, you know, goes into it. But I do want to be careful emotionally when we start nitpicking any words when it comes around physical abuse and saying whether something meets the criteria of physical abuse by the law, or if it was experienced as physical abuse and it doesn't meet that, or if it was experienced and it doesn't meet the definition of physical abuse, then it feels like emotional abuse, which is why we covered that early, that the impact of the physical abuse is significant in our lives. Mm-hmm. And that's why we do see that we see both the emotional experience and the and legally what happens and those kinds of things, how it affects people psychologically. So it is really hard for a lot of people to create a black and white definition because nobody wants to imagine all the ways that somebody could be physically abused.
And you make a good point too with the law. Like, laws are created because of case conceptualization and because of past cases. They aren't because someone is like, necessarily, let's think of all the things that could happen that would qualify for this. The majority of those laws, the reason that there's a definition is because a case specifically substantiated what that would be. So it's not even because ethically someone's looking at it and saying, this is mean, we shouldn't have people do this. Often it's just because of what cases went in court and what was proven and what was not, and what honestly won in court versus other definitions, right?
Well, and interesting, as you say that, right, even the APA says that there is significant controversy over whether certain forms of physical abuse, including spanking, are how those fit in.
And I was going to bring up spanking specifically, yeah.
Yeah, but it says the controversy is there because, you know, not all spankings are created equal, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But it goes into the idea of malicious or in the meant to inflict harm. And if you go into harm, you could be anything from reddening of the skin to wounding. And so we want to just really acknowledge here that there's a highly exact, like, there's a, what's the word? The range is so big here that it's hard to define it specifically for people.
Mm-hmm. So spanking is not effective as a form of punishment or correcting behavior because children will only remember the pain and they won't remember or connect the why they're being spanked. So just as an aside, if you believe that spanking is helpful, research shows time and time again that spanking just isn't helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, spanking is a form of control versus parenting, right? So if you want to look at it from that perspective of people are like, I don't know, you know, if I was to be the devil's advocate, they could say it is helpful. And I would say, but I like that your definition, Taylor, said, what's the intent? If the intent is to tie behavior to consequences, research shows it doesn't do that. If the intent is for your kid to be afraid of you, you're right. It might have been effective. And then we might want to talk about why you need fear to control your child.
Yeah, never touch a child in anger because you will always use much more force than you intend.
And it's interesting. To go into, so the child, so I was reading on the National Child Traumatic Stress Network about some things here, and it actually says that it can be even unintentional, so not deliberate, unintentional harm that leaves marks and or injury is considered abuse. So I thought that was interesting. Mm-hmm. When we talked about deliberate earlier.
Yeah, 1 in 7 children experience physical abuse in the U.S., and among impoverished children living below the poverty line, they are five times as likely to be physically abused.
So with that 1 in 7, let me just clarify that too. Is that meaning 1 in 7 have ever experienced physical abuse, or is that 1 in 7 are having consistent physical abuse?
1 in 7 have ever been physically abused before 18. Good clarification.
Okay.
Well, and let me add another clarification. Are those reported cases? Because if we go to that's what we know, I would imagine there's a level of unreported cases that would drive the number higher.
Great question. So there are weighted studies that validate the data. So essentially, you're looking at how often things are reported, and then you do anonymous blind research. And so then you're able to kind of extrapolate how much it's going on. So it's pretty close to probably what's going on. So it's not just going off of reported cases. That's a good question.
I wonder if we want to check in for a minute about what leads to that dynamic in a relationship. Do we want to talk about why has physical abuse become present?
Yeah, absolutely. Generally, it's because it was modeled behavior. And so physical abuse goes back generations. Physical abuse was the norm across the world and across cultures for millennia. And so this idea of beating your children or beating your wife was just normal. And just because it was normal doesn't mean that it was ever healthy in any time period.
I love that we talk about it. Well, I don't love any part of this. I shouldn't say that. I said,
I appreciate when we talk about these things.
I think it's
Needs to be
well, I
known.
think it's important to point out that this is a socially learned behavior. The other thing that I see is that physical abuse is often escalation when we don't have good emotional regulation skills. So if there's somebody who doesn't have language or they do have unprocessed emotion, that those kinds of things lead us into more reactive experiences. So we're talking about the different parts of the brain that are more reactive in that fight, flight, freeze than they are in that rational place. And so I think a lot of people say, "Oh, I meant to do that." You know, like they I we I don't know that we talked a ton about shame screens, but we talked a little bit about it
We
in
had
the
an
shame
episode on
episode.
it. It was shame number two.
Yeah, and so in the shame screens, right, that's moving in. And so some people are doing these things and they say they don't have a problem with it, but that in itself can be a shame screen about, I don't know how to stop, and so I'm just going to pretend like I like it.
Yeah, if you're the kind of person that says, well, I was raised that way and I turned out okay, 98% of the time you didn't turn out okay.
Or your version of okay is a lot lower than it should be. Well, and again, that's a shame screen sometimes we have for our caregivers is we might want to say, "Oh, I was physically abused, but I again, this goes back to what we talk about is but my mom and dad were really good people." Not only bad people make mistakes. All people, good and bad, have that limbic brain and can respond in fight, flight, freeze and make mistakes that harm people.
Well, speaking of the emotional part of the brain, physical abuse, like we talked about, the important thing of trauma isn't that we remember the trauma and it upsets us, it's that how it rewires the brain. So a child going through physical abuse will have a larger amygdala, that's the fear center of the brain. And they will have a smaller hippocampus. That's the part of the brain that converts short-term memory, what happened in the day, into long-term memory. And so they will become hypervigilant. They will always be looking for threats.
And
And go ahead, Haley.
oh, well, I was gonna say, along with that, like going back to what we've talked about with the brain structure and like the amygdala and looking for threats and that high awareness, that's where you're gonna see more, again, using that word, the reptilian brain, that's where you're gonna see that coming out because that's constantly looking for fight, flight, freeze. Your brain is it, that part of the brain has in that moment, I wouldn't say evolved, but it has upped its capacity than for those that have that soothing part that they don't have to feel like that part needs to be as overreactive. That part of the brain has overcompensated and has allowed that part that we've talked about, like the older part of the brain, not in the sense of like the oldest part from when that person was born, but the older use of the brain of safety.
The part that came first in evolution is what we
Yeah.
mean when we say older part of the brain.
Some people don't believe in that, Taylor, but
Well, join us in this fairy tale for a moment. Just pretend with us.
join with us. No, but I think it's interesting because our brain goes back to what it knows, whether it be in our lifetime or what its original purpose was. So when you're explaining this, what I think is really cool is that it's not thinking of the logic center of, well, I shouldn't be scared because of A, B, and C, or I should have these protections, blah, 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 right? Our brain just goes back to its original core usage of how we protect safety, which in that center, it makes it so that we do have more of those what do you call them? Impulsive reactions, right?
Yeah. So with a larger amygdala, you will see a threat as much scarier than it actually is, a neutral situation as a threatening one, and even a positive situation as potentially threatening. With a smaller hippocampus, you'll not be able to remember large swaths of your childhood. So if you're listening to this right now and you think to yourself, I don't remember a lot of my life before I turned 18, that's a sign of trauma. And then people that have been through physical abuse have smaller cerebellums. They have less hand-eye coordination. They have smaller corpus callosums, the bridge between the two halves of the brain. And so they have less ability to connect logic and their intuition and their emotions. And so they're unable to be able to check in with their gut as well.
Let's also just be very clear too, when Taylor's saying there's probably trauma in your background, we're not, even though this episode's about physical trauma, we're not stating it has to be physical. We'll talk about other options too.
Yeah, if you can't remember large swaths of your childhood, it could be neglect, emotional abuse, chronic stress, like we talked about in the first trauma episode.
Generational trauma stuff with that too,
Genetics.
you know, things like that. But that's
Well,
where when we talked about it in the past, certain therapies that are really unethical and not good will sometimes interpose a fake trauma scenario and say, you must have gone through this, because for them, those therapists didn't understand, or the client doesn't understand quite. Either way, there's a lack of understanding that it doesn't matter what kind it is, it can be any type. They felt like the only valid thing that would make your memory change would be physical trauma, right? So that's why they would say like physical or sexual, honestly, which also kind of goes under physical.
these brain changes are specific to physical abuse more specifically, but the memory thing could be anything. What were you? Go ahead, Jen.
I was going to say the memory thing comes from where they're at, but there are some people who have really vivid memories of their abuse because that's their visual sensors is how they're trying to assess for trauma. So I do have some clients that I've treated that have very intrusive injuries, thoughts, visions. That's one of the symptoms that we can see as diagnosing PTSD, but any trauma. And what's really cool is they now do have therapies for that visual, those intrusive visual thing experiences. And all three of us have now been trained in accelerated resolution therapy, which I found has been really effective for clients who do have very clear memories or clear visual impressions.
And so,
One other thing I was going to say, Haley, real quick, because I think it ties into this. I've had the opposite, like Taylor was talking about, where people come in and say, I don't remember anything, I have no idea. And that's where things like eye movement desensitization and reprocessing can be helpful, and or internal family systems. So there's types of
Those are two
treatment.
kinds of therapy, yeah.
EMDR and IFS.
So those are just different ones. So know that it's not dependent on whether you can get treatment if you have trauma memories stored a certain way. Just come to somebody who has some experience and they can guide you in the right direction.
And you don't have to know, like, I need this type of therapy. Like, we're telling you so you can be aware, but a properly trained therapist will know exactly how to do that.
A
And that's,
trauma therapist, yeah.
yeah, a properly trained trauma therapist. And that's something that, like, okay, like we've talked about life coaches, things like that. That's something that when we're talking about people who state that they do trauma work, we are looking for a licensed, clinically trained person, because when it comes to other areas know how to open up the trauma area. They know how to open it up, talk about it. But with these therapies we're describing that you have to have like a license for,
They resolve it.
they know how to close it, right? So it's the idea of like anyone can open up a wound, okay? Physical wound. Anyone can do that. We know how to do it. We know, and a lot of people know how to like do what they need to like see what the problem is and things like that. But a lot of the work has to be in how we close it. Not even how we close it, like, is it closed and is it done? Are we stopped talking about it? But am I going to have residual things come up? Again, thinking about like a physical bodily wound, you can open things up. You need to have a lot of know-how and how to do that. So people have that. But the actual closing up, you need to make sure that things are done the way that they need to so that still everything is functional. You need to make sure there's no infection, which for us in therapy, infection is equivalent to like coming up triggers, other anxieties after. Like we talk about at ART that they have the analogy of like, this is an onion. We peel back a few layers. Sometimes there's not much to it, so you don't have much to peel back. But sometimes when you go through a trauma, you're peeling back layers, especially with like physical trauma or any of the other ones we're going to be talking about. You peel back some layers, but there might be more underneath. And now that this has been peeled back, others might appear. Okay. So people who are fully certified know how to handle that is what we're stating with that.
You know, I think about how many, especially probably 10 years ago or more when I first started really specializing in trauma work, I remember clients coming in and saying, I've told my story so many times. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a good example of somebody who has opened up their trauma but hasn't closed it, right? Where they know their story, but they're avoiding telling it and because it is still so triggering and it is still so hard for them. Not that we should want to tell our story all the time, but they've continued to escalate and the consequences of what they're going through have become mm-hmm. negative. And so at that point, it was really important for me as a therapist to say, I need to know how to close this, not just how to open it, not just how to hear it, but how to help them resolve it. So they don't have to go tell more therapists the same story and work on the same thing.
Yeah, which especially when you learn how those techniques work and why we use them and what they do to the brain, like Taylor was explaining, especially with like physical one, it is often you hear like, well, the more you talk about it, the more you'll feel better. Yes and no. Like the more you review it, yes, it has been linked to the brain resolving things. However, it's how you review it. Like we're talking about the parts of a brain. There are certain questions you ask that are going to ignite the right side of the brain, certain questions that we're going to ask that are going to ignite the left side of the brain. And when you learn these types of trauma work, especially with physical trauma, because you can also deal with residual physical effects and that can often do that. But when you learn how to ask the questions in the appropriate way and in the way that they have set forth to show that it's most effective, you're actually not just helping them just talk about it. Their brain's actually rewriting the script of what they need to take from it. So I think just with physical trauma, to get back to that one specifically, you can recognize scenes from the situation. You can also recognize phantom symptoms of the scenario, right? I have a lot of people who have had physical trauma that I've worked with who don't necessarily, they're not being physically assaulted in any way going forward, but they still kind of have some phantom pains from those physical trauma scenarios that don't have a medical necessarily like medically sound reasoning of why. And these kinds of things we do with work can help with that physical sensation, not just the mental discussing of it, but also help with reducing those other physical signs as well.
I wanted to talk a little bit about understanding kind of the effects of physical abuse and how that shows up and why we do want to address it. It seems obvious that if somebody's been physically abused, you want to address it. But again, I think we talked about a lot of people will say, well, that happened to me and I'm fine. Taylor brought that up. So physical abuse can lead to the individual who's been abused becoming aggressive so that they were out of control. So they seek to exert unhealthy levels of control in their lives or with other people. This can include aggression physically towards other people, but just other out of control behaviors, out of control sexual behaviors, drugs, alcohol, spending, emotional eating, those kinds of things can all start to become areas where they're seeking to have control. The other thing that we'll see them do is they will actually avoid creating additional attachments, because the attachments, again, we talked about how it's most common in those family systems or in those romantic partners. And because of that they have a hard time trusting other people, and so they tend to be isolated and withdrawn, or that they tend to have only shallow relationships and they don't find people who have deep intimacy in their
They'll have that avoidant attachment style.
Right.
They'll have a strong freeze response. They'll have trouble using their voice and advocating for themselves.
Absolutely. And in general, they're just more anxious about things, because what your body is telling you is, if I do it right, I won't get hurt.
Which, that's a fun also response right there, right? It's the idea of, if I do this correctly, I follow along with them, they're not going to do what they would usually do or what others have done to me, right?
Well, I'm going to use a term. Fawn is the right term, but a lot of people call this perfectionism. Perfectionism is a fawn response. It's us trying to be perfect enough to get safety. And when we start to accept that as part of what we're doing, we can have some insight into working through that and realizing perfectionism is not happening in our prefrontal cortex. It's happening in our amygdala. Mm-hmm. Remember that we've talked a lot about trauma, so make sure to take a minute and be mindful. Connect with your body. Some, just even taking 10 deep breaths can help you get inside your body and feel that. Stretching is a great way to do that. I really recommend, if you're somebody who's feeling a lot of that pressure from holding that anxiety from physical trauma, looking into trauma-informed yoga or other practices can be very healing and helpful for you.
Mm-hmm. Preface for trauma sensitive yoga. So one day I'll actually get my certification, but I once was able to be part of a group that did that, and it was really great. And trauma sensitive yoga, unlike other yoga classes where the instructor might come and help you adjust physically and things like that, there's two things that go on there that are pretty different. One, the instructor never does that. The instructor will never come and touch you. You will 100% be in charge of being able to decide what makes the best thing for you. And two, rather than pushing you to try to do a difficult pose or to hold something, that's very mindful and body conscious. So you are going to have a lot of alternate ideas for yoga. And this isn't just so that like you don't have to do much for it. It's more the idea of some people, the idea of, they call it like cow and cat pose and things like that, can be very triggering for them. And so for those people, they might use a different pose or do it in a different way. And so those kinds of things, especially when it comes to like physical abuse background, that's definitely, I've recommended it. I've helped teach it. I think those are great options to be able to look at.
I love that, because it's so important to realize the thing that most people need as they're recovering from trauma is choice and freedom.
Thanks for listening. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please feel free to rate, subscribe, and review. And if you want to find us on social media, we're on Instagram and Facebook at Fate Resilience. We'd love to hear from you.